Welcome to Look Ahead Radio and Viewpoints Around the World. My name is Tom Arms, and in a moment I'll be joined by my old friend Lockwood Phillips. This week we're talking about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. We're also talking about the battle of the churches in the Ukraine and Russia, and the continuing problems of immigration in Europe. I hope you enjoy. Thank you very much for listening.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this afternoon, and looking forward to a very interesting conversation about events not only around the world, but in the U.S. as well. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking that Tom's had some interesting points pointed out to him about the events here in the States, particularly in light of what's going on in the Senate. So, as always, to remind you, this portion of the program has been pre-recorded to accommodate Tom's sleeping schedule since he is there in London, England. As we get into the program, Tom, well, good afternoon, late good afternoon to you, good evening to you. And what's the weather like there in the greater area of London?
It's a little bit cooler, a little bit overcast. Temperatures in the high 60s, upper low 70s, but you know, it's still very pleasant, very pleasant. The chestnut trees are starting to, the leaves are starting to turn brown at the edges and curl a bit. My sweet peas are dying back, unfortunately. It's always sad when that happens.
What about the temperature? How cool is it unusually?
Upper 60s, low 70s.
Okay, is this typical for this time of year?
Yes, I'd say fairly typical. We have actually had, I think, the hottest summer on record for, I think ever.
Let's talk about the rainfall, because there was a period of time there was the
England. Now. Grass is green, everything is nice. The farmers, vegetable farmers, have suffered. Things like broccoli and cauliflower, which are good British vegetable staples, they have been scorched and they're not as big as they were. Mm. And so the price of those has gone up something like 20-25% in the shops.
Okay. Well, this has, of course, been an unusual season for us all. We're enjoying a really unusual warm September right now. So we recognize, it's never take our weather for granted. All right, let's take on the issues of the day. And I think the topic I'd like to start off with has to do with Brett Kavanaugh. And that, of course, is the Senate hearings, which began yesterday. And I'm wondering, how well covered, how informed is the community there in the European region about our process for selecting justices for the Supreme Court?
Well, they're very well informed, and it's certainly getting a lot of coverage. We've got pictures of people being ejected, of women being dressed up as characters from The Handmaid's Tale, and you know, various people making statements. It's getting a lot of coverage. I think people are a bit surprised that the Trump administration is not releasing documents from the time that Brett Kavanaugh was working for George W. Bush, and they can't understand why. There is a lot of reporting about the fact that most people, most senators, actually think that Brett Kavanaugh is a good guy, that he's actually a very good jurist, a very good legal mind in that in all respects, but they're worried about his statement that he thinks that the president could not be prosecuted while in office, because that would be putting the president above the law. So that's I think probably mirrors what's being said in the American press.
Well, some of the items in the American press. I find it interesting that this is getting in the detailed coverage there in the European community as well. Related to the documents, of course, the observations have been made that more documents are being released right now on this candidate than were released on the previous five nominees or selectees for the Supreme Court, but and that's in total, total volume of documents.
Well, I think it must be clear that the Democrats' tactic is to delay the selection process for as long as possible, hopefully to after the midterms, which, in much the same way that the Republicans try to delay Barack Obama's selections. In his last year of office.
Yeah, Merrick Garland. Well, which in fact they did in fact successfully delay.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Let's talk about the coverage of Bob Woodward's recent book, and of course it's getting a lot of conversation, and excerpts are being released. How interested is the European community in that?
They love it. I mean, there are three journalists who are really very highly thought of when it comes to Washington politics over here. Obviously, Bob Woodward is one. Carl Bernstein is another. And the final one is Seymour Hersh. And generally speaking, they have a great deal of credibility with the public just about anywhere. And as one person in The Guardian said today, when they read the tweet from Donald Trump saying that that Bob Woodward has no credibility whatsoever, he said, "What? He has 10 times more credibility than the current occupant of the White House." it just seemed a pretty outrageous thing to say from a public perception point of view, I think.
This continued criticism of the president there in the European community. I'm wondering, of course, we're talking about this in relationship to the UK. The rest of the Europe, same opinion across the board, I guess?
I would say.
Okay. All right.
It's what can they do about it? They can't do anything. They can't vote. They can only just watch.
Okay.
And make comments in the press.
And, of course, that's one of the reasons we enjoy talking with you, is finding out where those comments are. Let's talk on an item related to prosecuting congressmen. And, of course, we have two congressmen that were recently identified by the Justice Department. But, interestingly enough, both of them are Republicans. What is the interest there in the European community? You obviously have listed this. I'm surprised by that.
Yeah, no, they're not interested in the case so much as they are interested in Trump's comments on the case, and that is his attacks on Jeff Sessions for basically organizing the prosecutions for when he organized them. Just for the midterm election, so that these two don't really have a chance. One of them, I think, is withdrawn. And I think that, you know, they have picked up on a lot of comments, especially from Ben Sasse, that Trump seems to be arguing in favor of a two-tier judicial system, one for his Republican supporters and the other for everybody else. And finally, I think what has caught people's attention over here is the question of when Jeff Sessions is going to go. And it's not, in their opinion, a question of when.
When, right.
Will he go before the midterms? They didn't think so, but they think he will go shortly after.
All right, we're going to get back to that more here in just a moment with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And again, to remind you, this portion of the program has been pre-recorded to accommodate Tom's sleeping schedule. But do stay tuned. We're going to be continuing this conversation. I want to bring up a real quick item on the funerals. There has been continued fallout about the two funerals recently, Tom. So right after this break, I just want to ask you about that that coverage as well. And, of course, the funerals of Aretha Franklin and Senator John McCain. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio here on the talk station, FM 107, AM 1240.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Tom, quick question for you this afternoon, this evening, actually, as we are recording this a little in advance of the airing of the program, but you will be nearly going on to 11:15 by the time where our audience is listening to this, and of course that's 11:15 your time. Real quick question. The continued coverage, and we're still seeing this week after, both Aretha Franklin's funeral and John McCain's. Of course, the relationship with the McCain funeral is whether or not now the Trump family was in fact invited to attend the National Cathedral ceremony, or the funeral at National Cathedral, and of course the topic of a particular pastor who gave a very frank and candid sermon to the attendees at the Aretha Franklin's funeral. I'm just curious, is there any continued coverage there in the European community, the European press, about those two funerals? Or is this just, what I'm thinking, is just an internecine issue within the United States? So I'm just curious, have those two items on the about the funerals, have they disappeared from the front pages of the European community?
No, they have not disappeared.
Okay.
They're very much there. John McCain's funeral, more so, I believe.
Interesting. Okay.
And I think John McCain is very highly regarded here. I don't know if you heard, but they want to name the new NATO headquarters after him. He was a very strong Atlanticist.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's highly regarded here. There were a couple of articles I found interesting. In which they said the last year of his life, McCain spent a lot of time and effort planning his funeral in such a way that it would be the biggest possible embarrassment to Donald Trump. He wanted to leave a political legacy which would be damaging to the president. I don't know if that's been reported there in the States.
There's been allusions to it, but no, it's not to the clarity that you have just expressed. So that's interesting. All right. So the funerals are still a topic of conversation.
Yeah.
All right. It was just an aside. I wanted to ask it here at the last minute. Let's look at the issue, and I think this is, of course, having to do with NATO.
Canadian cows. That's NAFTA.
NAFTA, I'm sorry, I said NATO, NAFTA, yes, NAFTA, right,
yes. NAFTA. And it really is a question of whether or not, you know, these Canadian cows are so important to Canada to scotch the NAFTA agreement.
Right, yeah, and what's the feeling now, of course?
And whether American dairy farmers are so important to Trump to give Trudeau a black eye.
Well, here's a quick question for you, Tom. There is some observations now that, in fact, Mr. Trudeau is having some challenges politically, and that, in fact, NAFTA has been somewhat of a millstone around his political neck, to use that description. And, of course, now that the U.S. has entered into an agreement with Mexico, does this not, and I'm curious what the opinion of the European community is in light of the fact that the U.S. has entered into new conversations and arrangements with the European community. I'm wondering, is there a feeling that Mr. Trudeau has, quite frankly, overplayed his hand?
No, I don't think he's overplayed his hand. I don't think they think he's overplayed his hand. I don't know if you realize it, but we recently had a Canada-EU free trade agreement. And that has opened up a lot of trade, you know, across Atlantic that way. And Trump has basically ruled out the possibility of a U.S.-EU free trade agreement. So I think, you know, there are some people within the EU who hope that if trade between Canada and the U.S. drops, that, you know, they will benefit. That trade with Canada will increase between the EU and Canada. The structures are already there. Now, obviously, you know, 70% of Canada's trade or more goes south of the border. So there's no way that the EU can pick up 70% of the trade. But, you know, they might be able to pick up some. And certainly it's obvious, too, that this is a bit of a millstone around Trudeau's neck. because dairy farmers, yeah, they're important, but they don't make as much as car manufacturers.
Right. And well, and of course,
well, they don't contribute as much to the economy as car manufacturers or steel producers or iron ore mining or things like that.
You know, you make a very interesting connection there with the European community and trade work with Canada. The events between Canada and the U.S. garnering a lot of interest there in the European press.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, I think Trudeau himself is very popular here in the European press.
Okay. That's
great. Yeah, and the general population, I think, would love Trudeau to win the argument, but they realize that he's on a sticky wicket, as the British would say.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on to another item here with you, Tom, and again, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. The United States announced that they would be holding back significant amount of money to Pakistan, and this, of course, related to Pakistan's harboring, I'm using that term, by the way, that's me using that description, terrorist, Taliban. What's the opinion there in the European community about that decision?
They have some sympathy for it, but they don't think it's necessarily the right one. You have to look at and the reason I stuck it in there on the agenda this week was because I thought it was worth looking at the history behind it.
Okay.
As to why Pakistan is in this situation. And for a start, Pakistan was part of India up until partition in 1947-48. And it was created specifically to be a Muslim state. So it will back Islamic causes. Now, in the 80s, it backed the Taliban, basically, or jihadist in Afghanistan fighting against the Soviet invasion. This fitted in very nicely with the needs and desires of the West. And so the relationship between Pakistan and the United States and Britain and all the other Western countries was very close, because Pakistan was supplying bases and being the conduit and looking after refugees who were Islamic fundamentalists fleeing the Soviets in Afghanistan, right, or fighting against the Soviets in Afghanistan. Right. Of course, then the Soviets left, the Taliban took over, the Islamic jihadists decided that not only did they not like the Soviets, which by now had disappeared and collapsed, they didn't like the lesser Satan, which now became the greater Satan, the United States. And so they turned against the hand that used to feed them through Pakistan. Pakistan, at the same time, however, still had developed this close relationship, which it had always had. It had existed before the Soviet invasion. It was only strengthened by the Soviet invasion. And it's difficult to break down those tribal and religious and cultural links. And that's the problem that the government has in Pakistan. And I don't think it's necessarily going to be solved by cutting off the aid. But people are sympathetic to the American problem.
Now, you say American problem. It's a European problem, too, is it not?
It's a European problem. Okay, should I say this? They're sympathetic to those who believe. They're sympathetic, but I don't think it goes much further. You know, I think cutting off the aid is viewed as being a simplistic solution to a very complicated problem.
Good point. And of course, the issue now, of course, is the future of Afghanistan. And, of course, Pakistan plays a role in that. But just one other quick note before we go to the break. Pakistan is also a, discomforted neighbor of India, and India is a very important community member, both for the European community and for the U.S. So there's some discomfort there between Pakistan and India, and Pakistan at times has been somewhat of a conundrum for both Europe and the U.S. And am I correct on that?
Oh, well, no, of course. And for a long time, the United States had much closer relationship with Pakistan at the expense of their relations with India.
Right.
So, during the Cold War, India had much closer relations with Moscow than it did with Washington.
Right. No, I think this is an important issue. All right, we'll take a quick break on that and come back in just a moment with Viewpoints Around the World with our foreign editor and, actually co-host of the program for all intents and purposes, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio here on Viewpoints on the Talk Station.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from LookAheadNews.com. Some call it the Chinese Marshall Plan. Others call it a dastardly plot for world domination and confirmation of the darkest fears of the Yellow Peril. The Chinese, with their easy facility for metaphorical phraseology, call it the Belt Road Initiative. The term is a reference to the old Silk Road, which dominated trade between the Orient and Occident from before Rome up until the 16th century, when the Europeans discovered the sea routes to America and the Far East. Those were the days when China was the world economic powerhouse. It was the land where an ancient civilization had invented paper, compasses, silk, porcelain, gunpowder, movable type, mechanical clocks, tea, iron smelting, bronze, rockets, the seed drill, and even pasta and the toothbrush. Bean counting historians believe that in the early 16th century, China produced 40% of the world's wealth. The Chinese see no reason why that trade and their position in the world cannot be revived by emulating the example of the Silk Road with an omnidirectional series of trade links and routes using land and sea. The term belt, in fact, refers to the land routes, either by rail or road. Road refers to sea routes. The project involves building political links in 71 countries, infrastructure projects to move goods, and massive injections of aid and loans to primarily African and Asian countries. The estimated cost is $1 trillion. Critics say that trade routes need to be secured by military means, which leads to military dominance. They cite the example of China's military buildup in the South China Sea. They also worry about China using its massive domestic market of 1.4 billion consumers to produce cheap goods that can be dumped on Western markets. Another concern is that easy Chinese loans are creating a debt trap, which is undermining the world economy. And finally, it's no questions asked aid and investment in authoritarian Asian and African countries is undermining the rule of law and governance in developing countries. Supporters ask, why can't the Chinese pursue their national interests through the pursuit of peaceful trade? And can we stop them? The 16th century was the Spanish century. The 17th century belonged to the French. The 18th and 19th centuries were dominated by the British Empire, and the 20th has become known as the American century. Most people believe that our own 21st 100-year period since the birth of Christ will be the Chinese century, and nothing can be done to prevent it. Finally, the supporters of the Belt Road Initiative point out that roads and sea routes run two ways, and the internet goes all over the place. The main target of the Belt Road Initiative is the European Union, with its 512.6 million people producing the world's largest GDP, $19.7 trillion. The bulk of its investment is going into infrastructure projects in Central Asia and Eastern Europe, which will link the two ends of the Eurasian landmass. It has bought a 51% in the port of Piraeus, invested heavily in infrastructure projects in Turkey, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Russia, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and the United Arab Emirates. The UK has broken ranks with the US and EU to join China's Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Eastern European members of the EU have signed political and economic agreements and meet regularly with the Chinese leadership. Africa is the next target. China needs its untapped resources and sees the dark continent as the next big emerging market. President Xi Jinping recently announced another $60 billion aid tranche for sub-Saharan Africa, dwarfing the cash coming from America and Europe. Much of the aid is in the form of soft loans, but they're not soft enough for developing countries who, it is feared, are falling into a Chinese-owned and administered debt trap. Beijing already holds 90% of Djibouti's foreign debt and 80% of Pakistan's. But then some economists quote the old adage, when you owe the bank $100, the bank owns you. When you owe the bank $100 million, you own the bank.
We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. We've talked a lot about pretty much the U.S. connections here, both in the world and in the European community. I want to move to an item here that will be more of a world issue. We've got several items I want to talk to you about. Palestine-Israel relations on the issue of refugees. Your note here is, when is a refugee a refugee? Your thoughts on this one, or your coverage on this one, Tom?
Well, this is in the context of the decision to cut back aid to the UNRWA, the UN, United Nations Relief and Work Administration, which is responsible for looking after 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Some in Gaza, some in Jordan, some in Syria, some in Lebanon, some in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been doing a bit of research on it. I did my blog on it last week. Part of the thinking behind this cutback is not just because of rows between the Palestinians and the White House, but also that there is a lot of talk about how do you define a refugee.
Refugee, right.
And as I understand it, Jared Kushner says that there are about 500,000 refugees, which is about 10% the figure that the UN has.
Hmm.
The Israelis actually say that there's only about 35 to 50,000 refugees. Now, they say a refugee from Palestine is someone who lived in Israel and was dispossessed in the 1948 war,
mm-hmm.
was dispossessed from their home, and is still alive. Well, 1948 was a long time ago, and so most of those people are dead.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, there won't be any of them left, and so there won't be any of them, any refugees, Palestinian refugees, anywhere. They say that the children of those people are not refugees,
uh-huh.
neither the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
That is disputed, obviously, by the Arab countries and the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is why I say, when is a refugee a refugee?
Well, and of course, this is a conundrum. And of course, how far back do you go to identify a refugee?
Yeah, what about all those Cherokee Indians?
Exactly. Or what about all the Irish and the Scots? Particularly
yeah,
the Irish.
The Celts.
Yes, and the Celts, yeah.
What about?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. This is kind of a deep conversation there with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and LookAhead Radio with us.
All that is true, but you know,
it's,
at the same time, although you could say the Cherokees are living in refugee camps in form of Indian reservations.
Well, it's
but, you know, we won't go into that one.
It's just the whole thing. I will leave it at that. It is an issue of semantics.
It's an important definition, which I think has to be dealt with.
All right.
And I believe there's going to be a plan coming out of the White House this month. And I think that definition is going to be absolutely crucial and at the heart of that plan.
Palestinian.
What's the definition of a refugee?
Right. All right, let's move on to another item here. I got to talk about Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. Apparently, the disputes between those two have really taken over front page coverage in some of the British press. What's the future of the Labour Party and the whole issue of Brexit? What's the future?
Well, you know, I thought I would addresses, you know, in terms of our annual party conferences. Every autumn, the major political parties, all the political parties, have a series of party conferences
mm-hmm.
at which they decide the major policies for the coming year. And this year is going to be really bitter. I mean, there are going to be some knockdown fights.
Ooh, apparently, there have been very, very strong words.
Yeah, Boris Johnson. Let's start with Labour. You've got two big issues coming up at the Labour Party conference,
mm-hmm.
and one is anti-Semitism.
Okay.
And really, the issue is whether or not supporting the Palestinian cause is anti-Semitic.
Okay. All right. So.
And And Corbyn is a staunch supporter, I mean staunch supporter,
right,
of the Palestinian cause. He's very anti-Israeli government. And he has been accused by the Jewish population here in the UK of being anti-Semitic.
Okay, now, he is running, of course, he would like to replace Theresa May.
Well, yeah, he's leader of the Labour Party.
Right.
And he would like to have an election and be elected. Now, the other issue in the Labour Party is whether or not to have a second referendum
on Brexit
once they know the details of the Brexit negotiations. Now, up until now, the Labour Party said, no, we must not have a second referendum. But it's getting to the stage where a lot of people don't like what's emerging from these negotiations and are saying, we have to have a second referendum. And the Labour Party is coming under a lot of pressure. The executive Labour Party is coming under a lot of pressure to pass a motion at the conference saying, we support a second referendum.
Okay, what does that do to Theresa May's leadership?
It would almost certainly mean we'd have to have a second referendum.
Okay.
Because it would tie the Labour Party members in Parliament to vote in favour of having a second referendum. And that would probably swing it, and you'd have to have a second referendum.
And would the second referendum, if it were to involve...
Who knows? We don't know.
Okay, but...
It's up in the air. It could go either way.
Okay, but here's my question. If the second referendum were held, and this, of course, a referendum on the exit by Great Britain from the European Union, if that referendum were held and the decision were reversed, and that is the Great Britain would have now be determined to stay in the European Union, how willing would the European Union be in receiving Great Britain? A quick question, quick response to that.
They would be delighted.
Okay, all right. They
would be delighted.
Okay.
But what I'd be worried about, it depends on what the actual results are. If it was overwhelmingly rejected, that is, in favor of staying in the EU, if Brexit was rejected, say 65% or something like that, then it would probably kill the issue. But...
If it's a close battle,
still close, you run the risk. I think you run the serious risk of civil disobedience here in the UK.
Okay, and then final question, because I want to move on to a few other items here with just a few minutes left in the program. On the issue of politics in the European in the European Community, pardon me, in Great Britain, I'm wondering: is this an unusual environment or is this typical?
Unprecedented.
Really?
I've been here for nearly 50 years, and I have never seen it like this.
All right.
Britain is usually a country where people talk to one another and they compromise, and it's known for its consensual politics.
Okay, what's the driving issue? Why? Is it because of the issue of the European Union, or is it other issues such as, for example, we've talked about it, refugees and immigration? Is there a concern?
Well, they're all tied. They're all tied together.
Okay, is it the populist movement? Is it
I wouldn't quite so far say it's the populist movement. I think immigration has been something which has been simmering for a long time, and it's come to a fore. But it's tied in with Brexit because so many of the people who come to this country are from EU countries.
Well,
I think that's part of the issue, and part of the issue is an issue of national sovereignty.
You've got a European immigration story here, and you say a plan is coming together. How so? This kind of relates.
Well, it is, isn't it? It's a sort of good news, bad news story, this one. And that is that the number of refugees coming, especially from Libya, which has become the big route across the Mediterranean, are dropping because the EU has been financing the reconstruction of the Libyan Coast Guard. And so the number of refugees crossing the Mediterranean has dropped by 2/3 because the Libyan Coast Guard is being put into action, and it is basically stopping the boats run by the human traffickers.
Right.
But as a result of this, the number of deaths has risen in percentage terms by 300%. And this is because the traffickers are taking more risks. They're overloading boats, they're traveling at night, they're going at high speed, all of which are things which will lead to sinkings and capsizings. So more people in percentage terms are dying. But fewer people are reaching Spain, Malta, Italy.
So what is the plan going to amount to? Do you have any idea?
Well, the plan is I think what's emerging is something that existed before Gaddafi was overthrown, mm-hmm. which was much closer relationship between the EU and Libya, and also with Tunisia and Morocco as well. Right, I think a lot of money is going to be poured into those countries
to do what?
Their security.
To maintain the immigrants, to keep them there, or to...
No. I suppose it would be keeping them there.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Well, they have suggested that they set up that the EU finance checkpoints on their southern borders, on the borders in the Sahara Desert. So anyone coming in from sub-Saharan Africa into Libya would be checked before they even got into Libya turned away at the Libyan border.
All right. In other words, turn back to their home countries, in other words.
Yeah, it's a bit like, in your case, having checkpoints in
Mexico.
Southern Mexico.
Okay, I just was wondering. All right, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this afternoon. We've got to take a quick break, come back. I want to talk about a few items, and then we want to get to, of course, always the unusual item of the day, and I'm looking forward to that this afternoon here with Tom Arms. Just to remind you that Tom is joining us by phone. Well, actually, yeah, by phone, Skype. And much earlier in the day, because as we air this program, he is, I'm sure, very sound asleep at some 5 hours ahead of us there in London. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World with our foreign editor and co-host, for all intents and purposes, Tom Arms.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Tom, several items we have not had time to get to, but I want to touch on real quickly. The issue of the battle of the churches, Ukraine versus Russia. And then you have another interesting story here. Russian pensioners are revolting. But let's start with the battle of the churches, Ukraine versus Russia. Very quickly, what is that about?
Well, the Orthodox Church is in both Ukraine and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Russian Orthodox Church, their spiritual, historic, and cultural home is Kiev.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Moscow. That's where the Russian Orthodox Church started in the 14th century.
Okay.
Well, Christianity came from Kiev. And they often look towards Kiev for spiritual leadership. And both countries are, ever since 1991, they have been extremely religious.
Uh-huh.
And in both countries, the leaders, Putin and Petro Poroshenko, have used the church as political pawns. And what is happening now is that Petro Poroshenko is urging the Ukrainian church to break away from the Russian church.
And how is that seen more as a political move rather than a religious and spiritual issue?
It's seen as a political move.
All right.
And of course, the Russian church is fighting this with the support of Putin, and the reason is because Kiev is their spiritual home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's where Christianity started.
Right, right. Okay, it's good for the Russian community, for that region of the world. All right, the other question, Russian pensioners are revolting?
Yes, they're very revolting.
Oh.
Well, it's the first chink in the popularity armor of Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
He took over Crimea. And ever since then, his ratings jumped from around 60% to 85%. And he stayed at that level until just this last couple of weeks when he's dropped back down to 60%. And the reason is because he is raising the pension age.
Okay.
We wanted to.
Right.
Now, it was incredibly low. It was 60 mm-hmm. for men, 55 for women.
Right.
And he's wanting to raise it to 63 for women
mm-hmm.
and 65 for men.
Right.
The problem is that the average life expectancy of a man in Russia is only 66.
Well, that was the original plan for Social Security. Unfortunately, with the U.S., life expectancy has gone way beyond the anticipation of Social Security. And, of course, now we're finding ourselves with a potential deficit situation.
Well, it's the same in Russia. And, of course, with Russia, they inherited the Soviet system.
Right.
And the Soviet system was very, very generous, as you can imagine.
Socialism, is there any surprise there? I've got to ask one quick question. The issue of Dutch dreamers, very quickly on that one, Tom, so that we can get to our...
It's two Armenian teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And their mother was deported a year ago. And she sent them into hiding with friends.
Uh-huh.
And they have become a cause celeb. They came out of hiding. They're just 12 and 13 years old. They've been in the country for 10 years since they were 2 and 3.
And?
They're illegals. They do not have residence permits. The court has ordered them to be deported and sent back to Armenia. They do not speak Armenian.
Okay.
And their mother is not mentally or physically capable of looking after them. Basically, there are demonstrations. They will be deported this weekend unless there is a court reversal. But there are demonstrations all over the country about it.
How about the rest of Europe?
They're not the only ones. There are 400 children, apparently, who are in their position in the Netherlands.
Okay. All right. Interesting story there. Then let's wrap it up with the world's oldest scuba diver.
Yeah. Ray Woodley from Merseyside, just outside Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
95 years old. And he went down. He's been scuba diving since 1960.
Wow.
And he went down for 45 minutes just the other day. And apparently he does 30, 40 dives a year at the age of 95. He set the Guinness Book of Guinness record for the oldest scuba diver. He intends to set it again next year. I mention it, Lockwood, in particular, because I just wanted to point out that there's hope for you.
Thank you very much. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this evening here on Viewpoints Around the World. Tom, as always, I look forward to next week's surprise story, as well as what's happening in the world politic and the world around us, particularly in the area of news coverage. As always, Tom, good evening to you.
Good evening, Lockwood.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of The Talk Station.